overcoming darkness, and the first verse that comes to mind, a reference that comes to mind, is from another section of the Gita where Krishna says, light and darkness are world's eternal ways. So where is the question of overcoming darkness? That thought comes to mind. If light and darkness are eternal, how can you overcome darkness? And what is the darkness that is mentioned there? There are a few very interesting stories that we find, and we should notice not just the stories, but the similarity that exists between cultures which are distant from one another, born in different countries among different people, separated by space and time, and idiosyncrasies of the country and the countrymen. Yet there is so much similarity in the stories, which only goes on to show that all world's religion come from a common body of knowledge. And all the great mystics and prophets and seers and rishis and hierophants, they all are different branches of the same trunk and root and the same tree. The first story that we will take is from Scandinavian legends, where we have the great, heroic, electrifying god, Thor. Now, Thor is very famous nowadays because of Chris Hemsworth and all the famous acting that he does in Hollywood. But then Thor is a very, very interesting god in the Scandinavian culture. And Thor is the hero. But he has his arch enemy, which is a serpent. The serpent of chaos, darkness, confusion, delusion, and basically all kinds of mischief. Right? It's called Jormungandr. Jormungandr, which translates to the world serpent. It seems this serpent was, when it was born in one of the other realms, along with its siblings and other equally hideous creatures, Odin found that they are so malevolent that he immediately banished them. And this serpent, Jormungandr, was thrown into the sea on earth. And it grew and grew and grew. And finally encircled the earth. And the story, the legend says that even today it is holding the earth tightly by swallowing its tail and crushing the earth, and noxious fumes come out of its mouth, and the fume is everywhere, and it is deluding the mortals. Something like astral light. Right? And it so happens that Thor goes on a fishing trip in one of the lakes on earth. And during the fishing trip, he insists that he goes to a certain place where that serpent is hiding, and he engages in a great warfare with the serpent in a lake body, in a water body, lake. And finally, he has it by the hook and he's about to slay it, but it escapes and then runs away. Isn't this very similar to what we find in Indian mythology of how Krishna in Gokula or somewhere there is a Gokula, river Yamuna, where he, Kalinga, he faces a similar noxious seven-headed serpent called Kalinga, who happens to be, it seems, the brother of Shesha, Ananta Shesha. So one is the supreme divine aspect, which is most ethereal and the most divine and the very Adhishtana, the basis of supreme spirit, supreme wisdom. And the other is this fellow on earth who is creating this chaos, reflection of it, right? So, and they're brothers. Even Kalinga, when Krishna is about to slay Kalinga, the wives of Kalinga come and pray to him, saying the glorious poem where they pray to Krishna, and Kalinga is excused and he runs away. So though evil is conquered, it's not ultimately destroyed. That's the second story. The third story is what we find in a similar story again in the Egyptian tradition, where the sun god, the Surya of the Egyptian religion, Ra and his archenemy, Apophis, the serpent of darkness, the serpent of primeval chaos, which is ever trying to stop the chariot of, or the boat or the barge of sun god, such that, you know, it plunges the world into darkness and confusion and delusion and chaos. So it seems every 24 hours there is this war that takes place between Ra and his entourage and Apophis and his hypnotic spells. And every night the sun slays the dragon or the serpent of darkness and emerges in order to bring order and, you know, harmony in the world. So there is this very interesting similarity between the stories, right? In none of these we find the serpent is ever killed completely. It's only banished. In fact, in the Scandinavian legend, Jormungandr, the world serpent, when it releases its tail from its mouth, it leads to Ragnarok. Ragnarok is pralaya, or the final dissolution, where all chaos is let loose. The Pandora's box is open and the gods and the devils have to fight one another. And in the story, interestingly, Thor actually kills Jormungandr, but it also bites him such that he takes 9 steps backwards and then dies. So it's as if when there is no matter, there is no job for spirit to. there is a regressive unmanifestation that happens. The universe ceases to exist. Right? So that, these are some interesting stories. And in all these things, the serpent of darkness is never fully banished, because we can remember what yoga aphorisms say, where it says the yogi who has completely perfected concentration and who has his mind stilled, for him, universe ceases to exist. For him, all the darkness and delusion of personal life is non-existent, but for all others, the universe is still real. The universe still exists. Right? So in that way, for the adept, for the prophet, for the great sage, there are no delusions. But that doesn't mean all intelligences, all embodied entities have attained liberation. That is never the case. So there's always this tussle between darkness and light. But when we speak to common men about darkness, it is very rare to find anybody who will associate darkness with spiritual darkness. You talk to your parents and relatives and friends, darkness for them will be darkness of not reaching personal ambition, darkness of personal sorrow, personal loss, disappointment, suffering. These are the things which a common man associates darkness with. It's only philosophically minded people who, when they speak of light and darkness, immediately put their mind on metaphysics and speak of knowledge and wisdom and darkness and ignorance, right? For the common man, it is, look at the symptoms of depression, the clinical depression, right? Feelings of sadness, tearfulness, emptiness, hopelessness. This is darkness for a common man. This must be addressed. How does philosophy deal with this? The kind of world that we live in and the kind of problems that we all face individually and the world at large. A philosophy which is in tune with truth or eternal verity should be able to answer meaningfully and quench the thirst of the soul of the man who is asking questions about these things, right? But look at this, pain, sorrow, suffering, disappointment. It is not that these things are unique to us, unique to me, you or anybody. It is sort of prevalent to everywhere, and it's pervasive, to use a Buddhist word, pervasive, right? And it is also not meaningless. It is also not random. It is as if it has a mind of its own. It has an intelligence which is driving this pain and sorrow into our life meaningfully, intelligently, with great plan. It comes and touches us. It is as if there is a purpose behind pain and sorrow. Look at what Through the Gates of Gold says. It says, pain arouses, softens, breaks, and destroys. Regarded from a sufficiently removed standpoint, it appears as a medicine, a knife, a weapon, as a poison in turn. It is an implement, a thing which is used, evidently. What we desire to discover is, who is the user? What part of ourselves is it that demands the presence of this thing so hateful to the rest of the part of us? So what the text is saying is, pain comes in variety of grades, and at each grade, or each intensity, it gives you opportunity. It comes first as a medicine in order to arouse you, in order to cure you of some weakness, of some disease. Right? If you don't listen to it, then it appears as a knife, which is painful. It cuts you in order to remove the tumor. Right? And even then, you don't listen and you headlong go into a direction which your own nature doesn't want you to go. Your own divine nature doesn't want you to go. Then it becomes a weapon and finally a poison. Right? So this pain and suffering is what Through the Gates of Gold calls beautifully as heritage of man. Pain, sorrow, suffering, darkness is heritage of man. Right? That's the first truth of Buddha, right? Dukkha Satya. And Tolstoy begins his famous novel Anna Karenina with a very, very catchy and a phrase which has become very famous, such that it's called Anna Karenina principle. And he begins with a statement which says, every happy family is happy in its own unique way, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own unique way. Let me tell this again. Every happy family is happy for the same reasons. Right? There's a common reasons why a happy family is a happy family. But an unhappy family, and each unhappy family, has peculiar reason why it is unhappy. Right? So this is just to bring to mind the three kinds of dukkha which the Buddhists speak of. First they say is dukkha that we all know, pain that we all know. I get a disease, or I lose somebody who is close to me, or I want to achieve something, there is disappointment, or I achieve it, but it turns out to be poison to me. All these things are common experiences. That is called simple dukkha. Dukkha, simple dukkha. But there is another kind of dukkha, next level, slightly subtle, which is called as viparinama dukkha, which is the dukkha of change. That is, you have achieved the best of life that you can achieve. For example, the best of the job, the best of the wife, and all the things that anybody can aim for. But still, nothing remains changeless. change is inbuilt into anything that you have at hand, inbuilt to your very existence. Your very existence is defined by change. So it's called viparinama dukkha, that is pain or suffering that arises from change. And the subtlest level is what they call a sankhara dukkha, which means pervasion of suffering. That is, no matter what you do, you know deep within you that all that you can gather is based on something unsubstantial. All that you can gain is finally going to go away, and all that you are building, it is as if that you have got the best of the designer and you are building the best of the castle, but deep in your mind it is gnawing you, it is eating you that you are building a castle in air. Right? So there is a part of us which, even when we achieve the best of the results for us, is discontent with things, right? It is called a sankhara dukkha. We all can introspect and find traces of these within oneself. And the word dukkha itself is very interesting. Etymology is dukkha, right? Which means du is bad, or what do you call it? Evil, bad. And kha means space. For example, birds are called khaga. Khaga means that which moves in space. So dukkha is being in bad space. Bad space where? Bad space mentally. Sukha is bad, good space mentally. If only physical circumstances, material possessions, were to give us really sukha in this sense, or put us in good space, we would find that all rich men would be happy, which is absolutely not the case. And all poor and people without means would be absolutely unhappy, which is certainly not the case, because generally we find the poor are more happy than the rich. Which reminds of what the judge says, that it is not that the circumstances affect us and circumstances vary. You put two people in the same circumstances, both of them see it very differently. If circumstances had power over us, the circumstance should affect these two people equally. Whereas that is not the case. Why? Because circumstances are not the variants, we are the variants. In other words, to put it in context of the talk that we are having, much of the time, many of the times, the pain that we feel, the darkness that we feel in our life, is a result of the attitude that we have towards our life, towards our circumstances, and the kind of opposition that we generate in our mind. It is that opposition, that kind of fighting attitude, which is a result of more pain than the circumstances which will trouble us. It's a very important fact to be noted, that if we change our mind, the same circumstance will begin to show, or will begin to become something different for us, and we will be able to gain something very meaningful, very precious, and we will be able to build a life of happiness and peace if we are only able to see the circumstance in its right, put it in right perspective. As the Chinese yin and yang symbol is there, right? In that, there is a dark phase, dark hemisphere of the circle, but there is a white dot in it, indicating probably in the sense that even in the worst of the circumstances, there is an opportunity for man to build a life subsequently which is far better and far meaningful. For this, his attitude must be not one of complaint, not one of blaming others, and one of taking responsibility for one's own life. All this because The events of our life is a direct result of our own past actions. A very fundamental truth of all ancient philosophy. That it is not that there is a outside entity or an outside agency or an outside person who is bringing us harm, pain, suffering and darkness to our life, but it is the hand that smites us is our own hand. The hand that feeds us also is our own hand, right? So if we understand this fundamental truth and take responsibility, then we will be able to see that by going through the circumstance that is supposedly dark for us, we will be able to not only overcome it, but remove the causes which caused us this pain and have the power to have a life which is far better than the conditions that we are currently in. Man has that power. In fact, man alone has that power to change his life. So this, as long as we see the source of our suffering and pain and darkness to be outside, so long we are deluded. There is the story of Maya that is not a story, it actually happened in the life of Ramana Maharshi. We know that Ramana most of the time did not encourage or did not respond to seemingly intelligent, metaphysical, Vedantic questions that were put like, what is Maya and what is Mula Prakriti? You know, that kind of question, he would just maintain a dignified silence. And it so happened that one evening in the ashram, he is, as usual, sitting and his various disciples are all posing questions and making comments on what is Maya, Maya is this, Maya is that, and so on and so forth. And he's maintaining dignified silence, not responding to anybody. And there is a commotion at the entrance of the ashram, at the gate of the ashram. And people inside get to know that a famous politician has arrived there. It was pre-independence era. I think Rajaji had come to the ashram, or somebody of that stature had come to the ashram, and everybody gets up, all the disciples get up in a rush to see and meet and greet that famous personality. They all rush out of the room to meet the person, and only one student is sitting with Ramana, and Ramana then opens his mouth and says, this is Maya. This is Maya, where everything that they want is within, yet they are running outside. So the source of our problem and the source of the solution to our problem is to be found deep within our heart and mind, in the seeds that we are carrying, in our feelings and sentiments towards others, towards other communities, towards other nations, towards our family members. And yet, when problems do come, which is the result of the seeds that we are sowing, causes that we are sowing, we always blame others. This is Maya, right? We don't look at solution within ourselves. So that is one thing. And the amount of pessimism that is there in the world today, the amount of confusion that is there in the world today, and so many writers, so many social media influencers trying to do so many things. But none of this gives optimism to man. None of this gives a meaningful hope to our life, because there is a deep-rooted cause for our pessimism in life. Right? HPB analyzes this, and she says this. I quote this from one of her articles. She says that as mankind multiplies and with it suffering, which is a natural result of an increasing number of units that generate it, sorrow and pain are intensified. This is so truthful, right? I mean, those of us who have worked in corporate world, we know that the smaller the company, the lesser the politics, the lesser the problems, the lesser there is mental conflict and burden on the employees. The larger the company, the larger the problem. So, I mean, this is so clear. As mankind multiplies and with it suffering, why is suffering increasing with mankind? Because there are more number of people generating causes for suffering, right? Sorrow and pain are intensified. But look at this. We live in an atmosphere of gloom and despair. But this is because our eyes are downcast and riveted to the earth. Our eyes are downcast and riveted to the earth with all its physical and grossly material manifestations. If instead of that, man proceeded on his life journey, looked but within himself and centered his point of observation on the inner man, he would soon escape from the coils of the great serpent of illusion. From the cradle to the grave, his life would then become supportable and worth living, even in its worst phases. In other words, it is because we don't have a vision of life which is transcendental. Transcendental in the sense, something which is beyond our personal miserable existence, and looking at life and our circumstances and the events of life from beyond the miserable narrow perspective of this personal life. It is because we don't have a greater vision that life is so gloomy and despair. But for one who has a vision of his inner self, of one who finds that there is something permanent in him, there is something divine inherent in him and in all others, he finds that there is purpose in life which is way beyond this personal existence, but yet every act and every event of this personal existence is meaningful. It is not that there is a disconnection between the divine and the personal, but the divine plan working through this personal life, in the events of personal life, in the miseries and sorrows, as well as pleasures and happiness of life, then these things will be evaluated and seen and understood and responded from that perspective, from the perspective of the inner man, the real man, the divine man. Then his life becomes worth living, even in its worst of the phases. So what is needed is a vision which is transcendental. Right? What is needed is a transcendental vision. And the same thing when we apply to societal condition, right? Because it's not that man is, I mean, we may today live our life as if we are disconnected from the happenings in the world, but that is not the case. That is not the case. As it is said, the world is an enigmatic mirror of what happens in the heart of man. So the condition of the world, the progress of the world, retrogression of the civilization are all reflective of the moral and the mental condition of man's heart. Right? It is from the heart of man that is springing the circumstances of the society, of the human race and the world at large also. And if we find there injustice, it is because in our life, in our limited capacity, we are unjust. If we find their exploitation and we are victims of exploitation, it is only because in our capacity, in our dealing with people who are below us in the social strata, we are the oppressors, right? If we find confusion there and chaos there and rascals being political masters, it is because in the city of the human heart, it is not divine reason which is ruling, but it is passions and rascal-like sentiments which are ruling our heart, it is because of this that that is vitiated. Yet there is hope. Yet there is hope. Right? And this hope is very beautifully, very poetically, very impactfully expressed by Emerson, who was so positive. He was very optimistic. He says in one of his articles, we have to read this, he says that things seem to tend downward to justify despondency, to promote rogues, to defeat the just. And by knaves, K-N-A-V-E-S, knaves, as by martyrs, the just cause is carried forward. The just cause is carried forward by knaves as well as by martyrs. Although knaves win in every political struggle, although society seems to be delivered over from the hands of one set of criminals into the hands of another set of criminals as fast as the government is changed, and the march of civilization is a train of felonies. March of civilization is a train of felonies. Who can deny this, right? Yet, general ends are somehow answered. General ends are somehow answered. We see now events forced on which seem to retard or retrograde the civility of ages. But the world spirit is a good swimmer, and storms and waves cannot drown him. He snaps his finger at loss, L-A-W-S, and so throughout history, heaven seems to affect low and poor means. Through the years and the centuries, through evil agents, through toys and atoms, a great and beneficent tendency irresistibly streams. Let a man learn to look for the permanent in the mutable and fleeting. Let him learn to bear the disappearance of things he was wont to reverence without losing his reverence. Let him learn that he is here not to work, but to be worked upon. And that though abyss open under abyss and opinion displays opinion, all are at last contained in the eternal cause. And he ends with a poem from Emily Dickinson, which says, if my bark sink, it is to another sea. She's actually copied this from another transcendentalist writer who says, if my bark is to sink, which means if death were to come, sorrow were to come, I am not distressed. I am not dejected, because if it were to sink here, it will arise in another sea. That is, even the worst of the circumstances have a silver lining in it. Even the worst of the societal condition has an opportunity for great human progress, if only we have our right attitude. So the actual poem goes, it's just a four-line poem. If my bark sink, it is to another sea. Mortality's ground floor is immortality. Beautiful poem. Mortality's ground floor is immortality. Right? So these are some points that the student wanted to convey. There's still some time. In case other students have something to say, we can consider it or take up any points or questions.
During your lecture, it was coming to my mind that today's topic of overcoming darkness, right? So, like Mr. Anguli Mala becoming a pious person, or Mr. Bharata in the famous Bharata and his brother, he understood that the whole the world is Nashvara, how his younger brother, he use up the world. So, or even when Valmiki ji, he realized that once upon a time before he wrote Ramayana, you know, he was doing all mischievous thing one friend. So these are all are the examples of overcoming darkness.
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely. You are certainly right. The examples that were given of Angulimala, of Valmiki, and Bharata, right?
Gomteshwara, which was like exactly. His younger brother.
Exactly, which goes on to show that, what we see of another person and the judgment that we pass on him so unkindly is so foolish on our part, because we don't know the potentiality that exists in each one of us, right? The potentiality for good, not only individual, but the good of all. That one person who seemingly at the nadir, at the worst of the rung of moral ladder, but overnight there is a possibility of change, where a miserly person like Purandara can become the greatest of the saints in the devotional, in the bhakti movement, right? So which goes on to show the potentiality of human nature for good. In other words, not to condemn others, not to judge others, which we so unconsciously do, which has become such a habit that we ascribe some person as bad, some person as evil, as if we are any better, as if the same flaws are not there glaringly in us, and as if when we are put in that place of temptation or power, we will do any better. We will probably do worse than him or her. So all this goes on to show that if at all there is to be darkness to be overcome, if at all there is darkness, it is within oneself. And if at all any darkness can be overcome, it is within oneself and not outside. Right? These are some of the points that we can take as a corollary to what our friend said.
One comment and perhaps a somewhat pedestrian question. So the comment was on from the beginning of the talk, we see examples of the chaos on one side of serpent symbology and of order such as thought opposing it. It brings to mind the psychological battle of Apollonian and Dionysian forces in man, but in a way not really opposed, as we see in the, you know, through the gates of gold, that man can be greater than the gods because of the animal in him. So that, because light and darkness are world's eternal ways, it is not the destruction of darkness, but rather to bring the power of chaotic energy under the rule of the light. This is just a comment. The one question that comes up, I'm sure, it's very pedestrian though. The modern way of dealing with, you started with clinical depression, so yeah. I wanted to kind of like address one solution that is very popular these days, which is just drugs, right? Like SSRI, like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It's like distributed like candy these days. How do we think about that? I mean, so if you look at the modern hypothesis around depression, it is that there is a chemical imbalance in your brain. If you can somehow pharmacologically fix it, that you'll be fine. What is the speaker and others here in the room feel about this?
Let's just let me make one observation on the first comment which was made by a friend. The comment was about how it's not so much of opposition as both working towards, in a way, towards a great end, but only to be brought in the right harmonious
relationship,
right? I am reminded of what Marcus says in the very second book that he wrote in his Meditations. And mind you, Marcus Aurelius, when he wrote this, was in the thick of the battle with the most abject barbarians, right? There is no question of, he's engaged in warfare, like he needs to slay them to protect civility and civilization and his kingdom from Germans at the border, Germans at the north, right? And there is political machination from within the empire. There are people who want to overthrow the king, and there's a coup being organized, and there is famine at the, in the center, and all that, great suffering. And he says, in the midst of this darkness, he says, even when you meet the worst of your enemies, the most Machiavellian, the most cunning, the most evil of them, remember that they are just, they and you are just like two sets of opposing teeth. Both are needed to grind food. They have their place, you have your place. You need to do your duty. Whatever they do is not your concern. Look at his philosophical perspective, where he is facing evil eyeball to eyeball. And yet he says there is no acrimony towards them. There is no animosity towards them. It's just that, like Emerson says, you are not here to be work, you are not here to work, but to be worked upon. I think what Emerson meant by that is that don't think that you as a personality is the end all and be all. You are to be worked upon as a personality by your divine nature for a greater purpose. Then your life becomes meaningful. So Marcus is seeing the whole chaotic condition that he is in, which we cannot even imagine, with that perspective of calmness, confidence, and eye towards human progress and perfectibility. All mystics have this great perspective about evil, where they are not as disrespectful towards evil as we are, and they are not as dismissive of evil as we are. And they have a very deeply philosophical, meaningful perspective towards evil. The second point was about depression, and it, the modern approach of depression, which is the pharmacological and biochemical alterations to be made. Yeah, any points, any responses to that, please?
My knowledge of medical field, just your background, sir, like professor.
Engineering, you don't need to do that, it'll pick up.
So, see, take for example a simple gastritis. You take one proton pump inhibitor called omeprazole or pantoprazole, or a H2 inhibitor called ranitidine. So out of the research of medical science, so everywhere there are receptors. So targeting the brain, neurotransmitters, neurons, those activity, and there are certain overactivity, lower, matlab, the, when we tell depression, lack of activity, where when we tell feel good hormones, you use the word chaos. Now, chaos is energy. When we tell energy, it is emotion. So how it can be stimulated? So it's all part of a process, and very well it is documented out of trial and evidence that yes, certain condition need medication. And when we tell, for example, how does a paracetamol work? How does it bring? It's a physiological phenomenon.
Correct.
Raising of temperature by the human body, how we boil milk or water to kill microorganism. But since we cannot tolerate, it acts on the prostaglandins to reduce the temperature. So it is similar concept where it is. But at the same time, only that might not help a person's willpower, or when we tell a breathing exercise, our body is a biochemical phenomenon. How a simple breathing exercise, say, when we tell Mr. Sri 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 Ravi Shankar or Sudarshan Kriya, yes, there is an advantage of breathing exercise. So all has its own place. Again, all has its limitation, all has its advantages. So, and it, again, it's how it is always mentioned, it's the wholesome phenomenon we have to look into.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your comment. Any responses to both the question and the comment?
Can I add one thought?
Please, please, yes.
From the Platonic point of view, it is the light of the inner man which floods out from each of us into the world. However, upon reflection, when the light returns to us, it interacts with the gunas of us. the imbalance of the sattva, rajas, and tamas, and therein lies practical cause for depression, as well as clarity.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the comment. The comment is, in the Vedantic perspective, there is a light that proceeds from us. Correct me if my understanding is wrong. There's a light that proceeds from us, and when the light interacts with the gunas that we have, and interestingly, just for Dr. Sek, Nimhans was conducting research on the three gunas some time ago, right? The three qualities. So when the light interacts with gunas, then a certain kind of interaction leads to changes in our mental condition, one of which is depression, right? That's one thing. Any responses? But one thing is very clear. One thing comes out very evidently and understandably so in the approach of modern science, which is that it is addressing the conditions such as depression and other things at its physiological level. Right? Obviously, because the very epistemology of science is such that it sees the physical as the reality. And emotions being an outcome of, at least by and large, an outcome of the biochemical changes that are happening in the brain and the nervous system also, probably. And if you are able to supplement certain things which are deficient, then it will lead to a different mindset, different emotion and sentiment. Or if you inhibit certain things, then it leads to mental change, which is not entirely wrong. I mean, as far as the terrestrial mind is concerned, you are able to do that. But has the root cause been identified, investigated, addressed? That's one thing. And that's the basic thing. Has the root cause been addressed? Is one thing. Yeah. And why did it happen? Right? What's basically why is a man? Why do we have different mental conditions? Why do we have different mental characteristics? You may say hereditary and other things, but ultimately we are just pushing the cause to one more level where our investigations haven't completely reached. That's all. As an alternative, don't deny this. In the sense, don't deny the medical part of it. That's fair enough. That's good. And that addresses things at the level, at the domain that it works. The effect. But supplement that knowledge with another wisdom where it says man is not merely biological entity, point number one, that mind is an independent entity which works upon the body, which is an ontologically separate entity which works on the body, and it is not the outcome of the body, but it is rather the body eventually is the outcome or the effect of our thoughts and feelings. If you reverse this ontological spectrum and take inner to be the real, inner invisible to be the real, man having a permanent aspect, which is divine, and mind being the lens through which he is coming in touch with nature, and body being a perfect instrument for all the faculties of mind and powers of mind to express itself and come in touch with physical nature. If we take this line of thinking, then the solution to the problem will be in man's thinking and thoughts and sentiments and ideals and ideas and the perspective and the outlook that he holds, where if there is a disturbance or a conflict that is caused there deep inside through the various channels which are as detailedly studied as a biologist and a physician has studied the physical body and the nerve centers and all the various things that doctors study in anatomy. Similarly, the inner has been detailedly studied If you address the cause there, the effect will rectify itself in the course of time. Not to say that medicine is wrong. Not to say that if I have a disease, I will only say I had created some cause in the past, so I will not take disease. That's not what is meant. But the root cause, the basic idea here is this, that man is a mental and a moral being. Physiologically, he has a temporary existence, which is cyclical in nature. He becomes a physiological entity, gathers experience, does certain things, and he goes back to his original condition. Right? Physiological expression is a temporary phenomenon. His real nature is not physiological and biological or chemical. Does this probably come close to?
Yeah, so the takeaway here was, from what I heard from the discussion, was yes, like whatever pharmacological interventions you know, have their place, but one cannot assume that, take away the wrong lesson from a pharmacological intervention when it works, which is that I am only the body, because when I fix the body, everything seems to have been temporally fixed.
Exactly.
Because the cause that gave rise to the effect is still unresolved, and that is not in the physical realm. Unless that is addressed in either this life or some other life in the future, that cause will express itself.
Absolutely.
And so they have their place, but also have to dig deeper and ask more whys.
Exactly. And even medical science today, sir, correct me if I'm wrong, insists not merely upon medicinal things, but other things which have to do with the mind.
Yes, definitely.
Right? Like that's, social connections.
That's like, why the concept of integrated medicine is evolving.
Absolutely.
Where, whether it is Ayurveda, wellness is the concept now, not just illness. Even when you mentioned NIMHANS, they are integrating holistic approach.
Holistic. Very, very glad to hear this.
Also, because time is nearing, I just want to mention this. It came to my mind. And overcoming darkness, I suppose, please, I want your opinion, is not a one-time process. It happens every moment to moment. Like, for example, even somewhere I have read, when you take Pandavas into account, or Duryodhana, that 100 Kauravas represent 100 vices, and that 5 Pandavas represent the 5 senses, where the fight happens in our mind every moment.
Very nice, very nice. Absolutely. Very nicely put. Thank you. So we will stop here.